I'm with you on that.
And stuff. Don't go in and get basic care.
Right, right.
And I was just wondering what that would look like compared to Minnesota Care, because Minnesota Care would pay for the basic stuff. It just pays only $10,000 on hospital.
Okay.
Jointly. Look at this.
All right.
We got a gavel finally. The agenda is very full for today, and we appreciate those who are on time. We appreciate Dr. Reed being here promptly, and the hospital's on time all the time, 24/7, so they're here, and that's good. And the good senators who are here. And I'm not sure there's a few of the presenters are here. Just to give you the context of where we're at, we're supposed to come up with some recommendations in the next meeting or so. We're focusing on medical assistance and public programs in particular, but other ideas. And so any one of you who's presenting today could go for 3 or 4 hours without notes. But if you can kind of help us talking about, we care about cost officially. I happen to care about quality. And access is also on our minds. But so as you kind of make it meaty and toothy for us, I see there's a bunch of handouts to come. So say hello to them.
I would. Hello and welcome to the committee. We all care about quality and we all care about access, but it is true that the focus of our work group, the charge we've been given, is to think about in terms of cost containment and particularly innovative cost containment ideas. So that's our challenge before us. And for members of the committee and I suppose for the audience, while there is a full agenda today, it is our desire to be out of here no later than 2:30 this afternoon, if for no other reason than this chair has another meeting. So we will try to move right along. And with that, we welcome Dr. Maureen Reed to our committee today. We are delighted to have you here. Dr. Reed has been very involved in this discussion for some time, and I know that particularly in the last couple of months, I can only imagine what your calendar must look like in terms of these discussions, because Dr. Reed has the pleasure of serving on the Governor's Task Force as well. So we welcome you and are pleased that you could join us today, Dr. Reed.
And just one more comment, just for time, because we want to get the material and stuff. If you read the agenda, 15 minutes times 8 is 2 hours. And so if people can talk 10 minutes, then we can actually have a few questions, or they can talk 15 minutes, and we'll say thank you for coming. So as you wish, but welcome, and please proceed.
Well, nice to be thank here. You both, both of the co-chairs and for the committee for having me here today. It's a pleasure to be here. It's an honor to be here. And this is the first time I've had the opportunity to testify in front of a legislative committee since the end of the last session. And I wanted to thank you for two things. First of all, your passage of the Freedom to Breathe Act, which if Minnesota follows along the footsteps of the other European countries who instituted this, we are already by this part of October seeing a decrease in the number of heart attacks being admitted to hospitals. So I am personally grateful for your work there. And I thank you, too, for your work in instituting the Transformation Task Force, the Governor's Task Force. I believe that Minnesota is the only state that has actually set forth its goals for health care as being coverage, cost control, and quality with specific things attached to them. And I think when you know where you're going, it's a whole lot easier to get there. So I'm glad to be here this morning and particularly focusing on the cost question as you have outlined. It seems sometimes as we talk about costs that we are just chasing the dollars with a butterfly net. And it doesn't give us very much comfort to think that that is exactly the way that we will go about getting the costs out of the system. So I wanted to hone in today on three things that I see as being just the basic background information that every Joe and Jane needs to know, and I'll bet your committee is extremely familiar with it as well. First of all, what makes us healthy is not the green treatment that we give primarily. Primarily, what makes us healthy is our behavior, 40% of our how healthy we are is determined by our behavior, some 25% or so by our environment, and some 25% by our genetics. So the treatment is a small part, and yet the reason your committee exists is because the green treatment takes up the huge part of the pie, and we have a little dab and drib and dab left over for the environment, for behavior, and for genetics. Our challenge jointly is to figure out how we are going to actually defund the treatment part so that we can put the dollars into some other very, very important things. And I like to think, too, and I like to sketch out when I am mentally preparing to think about cost control is how do we actually spend our dollars here in the state of Minnesota or in the nation? Some 25% of what we spend of the total health care dollar is administration. That's the green and the yellow on this chart. And this pie chart, you might argue, well, it's 25%, well, it's 30%, maybe it's 32%. It's a big number. And I have carved off part of that quadrant, though, as being green, because I think that is excess. We in this country spend more than twice as much as anybody else, any other country, on administration. And I see that as an opportunity to really improve the cost picture as well as the quality picture. And then when you look at the rest of it, the other 75% that we spend on care itself, the dark blue, 30% of what we do is either ineffective or unnecessary. And as a physician, it gives me little pleasure to say that there is that much opportunity in the system. So when you combine the blue with the green, you can see that we have an imminently doable task in front of us because there is, in fact, that much excess in the system. So what are the four cost containment strategies that I would put forth to you today? Let's change the conversation first off the bat. Second, let's change the structure, not the pieces. We're not talking about the bricks on the facade. We should be talking about the I-beams that are actually the structure and the fundamental things about healthcare. We've got to find a way of getting our mitts on the money. That's what your committee is all about. And finally, we need to align everything. And the reason that this is a challenge is because we know that the conversation right now, I think, is focusing in too narrow a way. And we should, and the challenge, I think, for this committee here, for other groups that we sit on, is to talk not about cost control because healthcare needs cost control. It does. But we need to talk about cost control, and we need to broaden the conversation and draw in allies from other sectors that are heavily impacted by the fact that healthcare costs are out of control. So we need to draw in allies from education, from transportation, from business, large and small, from individuals who could be and would be supporting our efforts at cost control if and when they knew that, in fact, their cost expenses in healthcare are impacting their ability to do the other things that they want to do. And finally, with regard to changing the conversation, not only in this committee or in other committees, is I think that we should be talking about setting an expectation now, as the legislature did and as the governor signed, that in fact, in Minnesota, we need to decrease the cost of health care by 20%. 20% should be flashing light that we put in front of people, because the waste is there. We know we can get it out. And yet, for those who are in the revenue stream, it's pretty scary to think that your canoe might capsize when we start talking about moving the 20% excess from healthcare into these other really important sectors. So the second thing I want to touch on is changing the pieces. It's changing the structure, not the pieces. I think healthcare, all of these issues come at us from 1,000 different directions, and we have to resist the urge of addressing or fixing the small pieces of it, like diabetes or heart disease or chemotherapy or intravenous drugs or back surgery. We need to resist that and talk about the fundamental things that make healthcare terribly expensive. we could waste all of our time on these small things, and we would never have the time then to address the real things that is making us difficult for us to get this challenge under control. So how do we get this challenge under control and get our mitts on the money here? There are really, I think, only a handful of places where we can get our hands on the dough. There is a lot of excess there, but when you think about what areas can you go after that you could actually constrain, that you have a hope of constraining, they are few. And it starts off with prevention. If we prevent through public health measures and through preventive services in the healthcare delivery system disease, those are individuals that are not going to be accessing the system at all at the high level. And so that is an area that this committee and that other committees really have to go forward with very, very forcefully. A second area, benefit set. Depending on how wide or how narrow we draw the benefits, and I know that there are other committees looking at the benefit set, but this is the opportunity to constrain, because when the benefit set is large, everybody expects everything that is in the benefit set. When the benefit set is constrained, there is a hope of actually getting our mitts on the money. Third, incentives. The way we pay physicians, providers, and the way we incentivize individuals is an opportunity for getting the money out of the system. Fourth, new technology, procedures, drugs, and I'm going to dwell on that just in a few minutes a little bit more, but we need a wholly new way of thinking about this. I was the last few days at a conference Dave Durenberger and others had sponsored, the Medical Technology Leadership Forum, the medical arms race, and I know you have a big discussion later on your agenda with regard to this. But upwards of 30 to 50% of our increasing costs are related to this thing. And if we don't get our hands around and don't have new ideas for how to address new technology, procedures, and drugs, we will flunk the test. Facilities, I think, is another issue where we could go to, and administrative services. So prevention, I just say two words. Tobacco, you've already taken strong steps. You could take stronger steps here in using an increase in the excise tax to offset other taxes and to drive down the use of tobacco. You could link it to premiums. When it comes to behaviors, there are three things that work. Making something more expensive, less accessible, and less acceptable. And this works for tobacco as well as for obesity. We need to set goals and timetables for prevention of the things that are making us sick and killing us and that are most expensive. The benefit set, I'm not going to dwell on that. I believe that there are some narrow places where we should be focusing. We should also be making sure that we eliminate the copays for the things that we want people to access, and we want to make sure that we have a different way of dealing with the new stuff, the new treatments, the new technologies. We should reserve the benefit set for those things that we know works. Patient incentives, I have no personal trouble in saying that there should be premium breaks or surcharges for individuals who are engaged in proper health behaviors and who engage in achieve the optimal results. And I think that pay for performance or payment for outcomes is another really important area where we should be asking the medical delivery system to come to the table and to grab this one with both hands. I'm very proud to say when I was at Health Partners 8 or 9 years ago, we started the first pay for performance program in this state, and it might have been one of the first in the nation as well. We know in this state a lot about pay-for-performance. We should start paying for what works and stop paying for what doesn't work. I mean, stop paying for what doesn't work. And we should make the outcomes payments large enough that the delivery systems are keenly engaged and involved in driving towards the outcomes that we want to see. And then we need all payers to adopt these same kinds of standards. It doesn't help us too much if we have just one or two payers, a public payer, that operates on this particular system. This is an area I want to touch on just for a few minutes. I have been baffled through my whole career in healthcare on how we constrain new stuff that's coming down the pike. And I believe we should carve off the new stuff, the unknown if it works stuff, into a different pot entirely and say, we will cover this if this new treatment, this new procedure, this new drug is given to a patient in the context of a randomized trial, a controlled trial, where we can actually have a hope somewhere down the road of knowing whether this new procedure, treatment, or drug actually works. Right now, we have not a great ability to do that, although Medicare is working on this kind of scheme right now. But we need to take these treatments that are unproven and put them into an entirely different category of payment. We need to carve them off. And I would be very keen to hear your committees and others wrestling with this as we go forward, because I don't see that we get our arms around the medical arms race and technology unless we treat these things differently. And with regard to facilities, I would just say the Citizens League laid out a report in April of 06, the Department of Health laid out a report here about 6 months ago. There's a lot of meat in those reports. And it would not hurt my feelings one bit if the state of Minnesota decided to link the tax-exempt status of healthcare facilities to the actual community health that they contributed, so that we ask something very aggressive of the not-for-profit organizations that operate within our state. Finally, on administrative services, we've got to standardize the definition of administrative services. I think we should set a goal for what we expect to be the maximum amount that we spend in the state for administrative services, and that we actually go about eliminating the need for certain administrative services like underwriting. If we move forward, for example, in this state with insurance reform that does guaranteed issue and statewide community rating with age banding, this would move that agenda forward. And there are also other administrative services that we should really ask ourselves whether they're eligible for compensation at all. How much do they contribute to the overall good of patients and the overall good of society? Then we take all these pieces and we align everything. We start off with what constitutes best care and what's known to be best care. We match it with a benefit set that is narrow. We pay for the results of delivering services on that benefit set, and we encourage patients to adopt the same kinds of behaviors. And then we figure out a new way of dealing with new technologies so that at the top of this pedestal, adding that block on doesn't tip over the whole pyramid. So four cost containment strategies for you to consider: changing the conversation, changing the structure, not the facade, not the pieces, getting your mitts on the money, and aligning everything. And the opportunity is there in the blue and the green, and it's huge. So I welcome any questions that might be put to me, and I thank you very much for this opportunity.
Thank you very much, Dr.
13 and a half minutes, that's very good. I have a question, and then maybe others can have questions too. So let's say I live in a world of, I'm a chiropractor, you know that. Let's say that we find we can prevent some back surgeries, and they use more of us. How do you get the surgeons to not miss the money in the real world?
How do you get the surgeons to not miss the money?
No, how do you reallocate from one system to another one if it really works better to make your idea? I like your idea.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody would say it's a great idea until you take away their dollar. How do you get that to happen?
I think that is the issue in changing the conversation. I think that we need to be very honest that a lot of what is happening now in healthcare is not value added. And when we're very honest to say these things over here are not value added, we are going to be tapping that part of the revenue stream. There will be a hue and a cry. I am sure of that. On the other hand, when I think about patients, when I think about Minnesotans, when I think about what needs to be done, I am comfortable in talking with specialists and saying, in this area, there will be less money. That revenue stream is going to shrink. And we know that taking 20% out of healthcare is a big challenge, but it's no different, really, than the challenge that we have in, for example, when we're going from three high schools in a community to two high schools in a community. People fight tenaciously to keep on with that third high school, even though the need has changed. And so it's very much getting our other allies to help carry the message forward and being very realistic that there are going to be people unhappy with this. But for the greater good, we have no option but to proceed.
Questions from or comments from committee members? I will just offer two things. One, at the beginning of your presentation, you talked about the excess administrative and excess clinical costs. I don't know how many of the people in attendance here today were at recently the Healthcare Access Commission, the full commission, heard a presentation, a very thorough presentation on the medical home model. And it's my understanding that both the Healthcare Access Commission and the Transformation Task Force, I think that's an area of commonality, at least in terms of discussion items. And it occurred to me that that model might very nicely fit in with seeking to address some of those excess costs that are inherent in the system.
I would agree with you, Senator Lynch. I think that it not only could, but it should when you think about it. I would say that there does not need to be any new money put into the system to see that happen. And I would also say that when we focus on outcomes and start paying care delivery systems for outcomes of care, they would be hard-pressed to deliver sterling outcomes if they didn't do the medical home model. I think it makes all the sense in the world, but I would not be, I am not thinking of it personally as another fee, another service that needs a fee. I think the outcome that we look at is best diabetes care or best asthma care, best heart care. And the savvy care system will say, in order to achieve those best results, we almost have to do the medical home model because you can't get there with piecemeal care.
And my other comment, sort of as a, this was maybe a nice little checks and balance for the work group, the slide that talks about, you know, some particular ways that you might go about addressing this through prevention and benefit set in incentives and new technology, I am pleased to say and communicate to you that those are all areas that this work group and certainly other work groups have touched upon in the last couple of weeks and months. So it makes me feel like even though sometimes we feel like we're swimming or treading water in this vast ocean, I think that we're in the right arena.
I believe that we are. Although I'm not here speaking for the Transformation Task Force, I am very excited with the work that group is doing and to see the complementarity of it with the work and the things that you all are talking about. I don't think that we have ever had an opportunity as golden as this, and I think that it is within reach.
Thanks a lot.
Thank you very much, Dr. Reed. Next on our agenda is Dr. Bruce McCarthy. Dr. McCarthy joins us today as the Chief Medical Officer of Allina Hospitals and Clinics. Dr. McCarthy, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Copies of my presentation, if anyone...
We'll get those distributed.
And Dr., you were here for my comments about 15 minutes, right? Did you hear that?
I have revised my presentation with that in mind.
I'm liking that. Thanks. We wish we had more time, just that so much stuff is landing on each of these meetings. So. And just for the audience while we're preparing here, I think the medical arms thing is going to come at the end. We'll be doing the county's part after this. I think the medical arms folks are coming here on one. So.
They hear
So if you've been waiting for that part, you have another half hour. You can go. But you wouldn't want to miss these next presentations either. So
thank you.
Okay. Pat, did you have a question? Ms. Caldwell, did you want to say something?
Oh, I was actually going to ask Dr. Reed something.
Oh.
But that's okay. I'll catch you later.
You want to make it turn it into a comment, which most of us do anyway?
No, I actually wanted some more information.
Really?
That wasn't something that I already knew, Representative Abler.
Okay.
Inquiring minds, you know.
Yeah. You good to go?
Okay.
Welcome. Introduce yourself for the tape and then proceed, please.
Thank you. I'm Bruce McCarthy, the Chief Medical Officer of Alina Medical Clinic. Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm pleased to be presenting today. I have revised my talk, and I'm going to try and hit just the highlights so I can get in under my time limit here. First, I want to explain Alina Hospital and Clinics is a health system, 11 hospitals, many clinics. I am the Chief Medical Officer of the Alina Medical Clinic, a 500-600 physician multi-specialty group. I skipped through our mission and the challenges. I know you know those already. And I want to go to our strategic vision. This is our plan to improve the care of patients and the patients that we see and help the communities that we serve through prevention, wellness, chronic illness management, acute and critical care, and end-of-life care. I'm going to talk about some initiatives we have done, particularly in the middle two categories, but we believe that we need to be working in all. And I want to bring up an example for each of the N2 boxes. In prevention and wellness, we're working to improve flu shot vaccination rates among hospital workers and healthcare workers in our system. Last year, we were able to increase the vaccination rate from 30% to 67% using something called a flu shot declination form. Now, this requires healthcare workers to either, you know, get a free flu shot or to at least acknowledge that they were offered a free one and have been informed of the risks of not getting one, not risk to them, but risk to the patients. And in place after place, healthcare worker vaccination rates have improved, and the evidence says harm to patients goes down. That means cost goes down. So five other states that I know of have regulatory requirements to require declination forms as a way to prompt and promote vaccination of healthcare workers for the flu. Immunization is one of the few healthcare interventions shown to reduce costs rather than just break even. On the end-of-life care, we've been working hard with hospice and palliative care department that we have to help physicians learn how and when to offer end-of-life planning to patients. The most shocking thing for us is that so much of healthcare expenses is delivered at the end of life, and that's not shocking. That's, I guess, expected. The shocking part is a lot of people don't want it. So if you want to focus on an area to reduce costs of care that people don't even want, find strategies to promote end-of-life care, including coverage for certain benefits, requirements for reporting of how well health systems are doing and doctors' offices are doing on promoting this area. But let me go to a couple other initiatives that we've been working on. This is our graph of what percent of our patients have optimal diabetes care. So this represents the care for 17,000 patients with diabetes. In a little over a year, we've gone up from 11% to 26%. That's a big increase. We're probably one of the leaders in the community now, but we have a long ways to go. The impact of this for our 17,000 patients is over the next couple of years, fewer strokes, fewer heart attacks, fewer deaths, fewer cases of diabetic eye disease. Controlling diabetes, one of the a few interventions that reduces costs while you're delivering it. The answer to that is probably when you consider all things in, but it's one of the high leverage areas to be working in. Depression care, we've improved our depression screening, another area that pays off when you consider productivity, not just healthcare costs. Another initiative is rapid response teams. That means instead of waiting for the patient to get so sick their heart stops or their breathing stops and you call a code and put them in the ICU, where costs are thousands and thousands of dollars a day, you set criteria so the nurses alert the doctors or alert the rapid response team to see the patient before they code. Our rate of rapid response team calls has gone up steadily. We've more than doubled it in the past year per 1,000 discharges. And the rate of codes outside the ICU has gone down by about 40%. That's good. You can promote those things. Don't cost more money. They cost a little bit more money. And creating incentives for this to happen, I want to make a point that is more than financial incentives, that the tools that we have, there are social incentives. So making this data as transparent as possible helps move health systems, move doctors, energize them to be putting the right systems into place. Preventing childhood obesity, another thing we're working heavily on. This is probably of too long a timeline for you to be thinking about, but this is where a lot of the action is. It's a multi-year strategy, but obesity, some estimates are that it accounts for 7% of direct U.S. medical expenditures annually. It's phenomenal. If we can do things in the schools in particular and in the community to prevent obesity, well, Align is working on it, and the more people that helped us, the better. I think you've talked in other sessions about CHF management, too. We have a program as well. We reduced CHF readmissions in one of our pilot hospitals by 40%, and we can do the same in other places, too. I think this is another area that reduces costs. The literature would suggest reduces costs, and making that a priority for the state and for the healthcare systems in the state, I think, would be well spent effort. And we're working on accessing medical records across the settings, across the various hospital settings and what have you. This will help. A lot of care is redundant. We could avoid a lot of it if we had better access to information. Another way to promote that is to make information more available to patients so that they become the stewards of their own medical records. Then when you have a patient and an internet access and a doctor says, well, to that MRI show, instead of ordering another one, the patient can say, well, hey, let me log into my medical record, and I'll tell you. So we're involved in this. This is a very good thing. It will take time. Another way is to promote individuals to use it. Thank you.
Really? Thank you. We can take questions.
Questions or comments from committee?
I have a question, but I'll wait for somebody else if they want to ask one. Yeah, doctor.
Thanks. Hi, Dr. McCarthy. Mike Lenz from Medica. Good to see you. As we look at currently at quality measures that are available in the marketplace, there doesn't seem to be any correlation between high quality and large systems or small systems. But as we look at our cost data, both within the health plan and publicly available, there do seem to be, at least currently, the large systems costs more than the smaller systems. Do you see that changing over time with the onset of the electronic medical record, or what are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I think in the short run, I think costs are higher because of electronic medical record, and eventually they'll go down. I think it would be important to consider the types of patients that different health systems take care of. If it were risk adjusted, that would give us a lot more information. If it's not risk adjusted, then you run the risk of a Mayo or something like that looking expensive when they're taking care of very ill patients. Abbott Northwestern Hospital, our hospital, takes care of very sick patients, so it's a little bit hard to compare apples with apples. If we could, boy, we should get that data out there and be very transparent about it.
I'll ask my question then. Dr. McCarthy, we're talking about costs. And every so often we get visits from various entities who do a service that you do at a price that's nowhere near what you have to charge. Colonoscopies, for example, they're around these days. And the differential could be 40% compared to 100% or something like that. Same doctors even doing the same procedure in a freestanding site. If, as Dr. Reed suggests, we took away all the stuff, we right-sized the system, took 20% away from where it should have been spent more cleanly. What would happen to you? And what happens there? Let's say you quit doing colonoscopies. Would some other costs go up at your clinic for some other service, do you think?
That's a question I'd have to reflect on, but I think the answer may not be to stop doing colonoscopies. I think it might be to redesign ourselves so our colonoscopies don't cost any more than other places. And that's exactly what we're trying to do right now, is to develop more ambulatory colonoscopy suites. Because I think I think having an integrated as part of the health system is good. I think care around Minnesota is very fragmented, in my experience. So I think the answer is for us to redesign the hospital system so that the cost of care and delivering care is lower.
And that seems like the obvious answer. But how
would we do
it's nice to talk instead of having presentations all the time, even sometimes. But it occurs to me that maybe that part of the colonoscopy cost at the typical hospital helps subsidize the ER or some other part. Is that true, or am I wrong about that?
It is true, but there are certain services, I think, that will move quickly to outpatient centers, partly because the incentives for patients now are such that they can't afford hospital-based services for some of the common procedures. So, yes, while an emergency room visit will always be expensive because there is some cross-subsidy between, you know, different types of services and different types of patients, other outpatient services, sort of the bread and butter, ought to be priced competitively so that patients can afford it. I think that's already happening.
Do you see a model shifting where somehow that we redefine the role of a hospital to be more the acute intensive kind of care facility compared to, you know, cardiac rehab or whatever could be done, you know, any old place? And so maybe, I mean, do you see that going then where you would actually rent out the top three floors to clinicians who would just rent space and it wouldn't be, is there anywhere to go with that?
I don't know about renting the top three floors, but I think that some of the redesign you're talking about is already going on. You know, we have patients now that, you know, several years ago used to stay in the hospital after hip or knee surgery, and now we move them to transitional care units. And because it's a much less intense form of care that they need, they don't need to be in the hospital, don't need to be exposed to hospital infections either. And so that care will be delivered outside of the hospital. So I think that transition is going on. And then the things that really need to be in a high-tech hospital will occur, and the, you know, the reimbursement for those services will be appropriate for the services that we want to have happen.
We have 2 minutes left, members, if you want to ask more questions. Because I have 2 more minutes for the questions.
I have
go ahead.
One opinion I'd like to share, and that's about whether we should just pay for outcomes or pay for processes of care. I think it should be both. If it's just outcomes, then it's a very risky thing, and people may choose not to invest in the infrastructure it needs that we need to improve diabetes care, CHF care, or what have you. So I think the reimbursement has to be both for the process, you know, the contacts with a nurse or what have you, and on outcomes. So there might be separate payments for that. So you get what you want, which is to really reward the outcomes, but you help pay for the infrastructure in a timeline that doctors' offices and health systems can respond to build what's needed.
And go ahead.
I'll just offer a final comment, and that is that in a number of the things that you mentioned specifically, I see the commonality in that you're suggesting that there needs to be, or in more in a more concrete way, the communication between the physician or the person that's delivering that service, whether or not that's the physician or the nurse or the what practitioner, and the patient. And if that's diabetes or if that's the end-of-life planning or if it's the childhood obesity, I think that that's been a common theme. And I will say that when I first came into this discussion, not all that long ago, I think that I was under the assumption that, for the most part, that those kinds of conversations were naturally happening. And clearly, that's not a natural part of this process. And there's a tremendous room for growth and improvement in that area. And I can, while something so simplistic, you and others are showing very clearly that the evidence will show us that that's going to yield huge rewards. Ms. Stout.
Madam Chair, Dr. McCarthy, I'm thinking about best practice standards and something You talk about congestive heart failure and diabetes and using best practices standards in those specific areas. Can you help me to understand what could happen if the payment structure was solely targeted on best practices in all areas? I know that the standards exist. I've seen the books. There's standards for everything from, sore throats to bunionectomies or whatever. And the question is, if it took all of those best practice standards and based our payment structure on following that, do you think that's a good idea, bad idea?
I think that I think in general it's a good idea. I think we should be rewarding the right care and not rewarding the wrong care. I think as Dr. Reed said the same thing. So I think that'd be a good idea. It is hard to put all the systems in place quickly. So I think what I would recommend would be going after the high leverage areas first. I think that there's been a lot of progress in the last couple of years. In Minnesota, we lead the country in a lot of these things. I think we should focus on a few high-leverage target areas and do exactly what you're talking about.
Okay. Well, thanks.
All right. Thank you very much, Dr. McCarthy.
And I said before we were going to alter the agenda. I guess we're going to stick with it the way it is. So, Mary is here. No. I said it before. I'm sorry. Okay. Okay. That's what I get for talking out loud. And to the medical arms folks who are here, there's some anomaly an hour put aside for that. As you present, if you can make sure that you don't say what the last person said, too. So. Should do the comments.
Yeah.
Okay, yeah, come on up, Rena and Mary. Yeah, the counties came to us and said they'd done some stellar work and they were making the world a better place. And we thought no two better counties to think of than Olmsted and Anoka County to come. And I don't know how we thought of those two. I think they must be two of the best counties in the state of Minnesota. Anyway, welcome to the committee. And between the two of you, you've got, I don't know what you have. You've heard the talk about focusing and stuff. So I know you'll do that. So welcome. Do you have handouts that we have?
They were on the table.
I believe
we do.
What do they look like?
With that introduction.
What's your handout look like?
It's three graphs. And I believe they're packaged and ready to go.
We have a deck of handouts, so just could you hold up what the three they are?
Okay. Well, as we come to them, we'll reference them. You'll be able to identify
them. You can do the Vanna wipe, I think. And just show us the hand. Great.
Okay.
Well, welcome to the committee. Identify yourself.
All right. Thank you. My name is Rena McManus. I'm the director of Anoka County's Community Health Department. And Mary Wellick, who is my partner here, is director of Olmsted County's Public Health Department. And I'm going to begin and will be sharing some comments as we go through our presentation. And obviously, we're pleased to have the opportunity to be here today to discuss the roles that the county has played in containing costs of health care and to encourage you to consider what we believe to be some future cost savings. Looking at some expansion, if you will, into some very successful public health and social services programs. And our colleagues from the counties, Linda Stein and Patricia Caldwell, can help us answer any questions I'm sure you might have. Unlike many other states, Minnesota counties delivered the bulk of public health and social services. In Minnesota, we do this directly or through with contracts with other entities. And through this, we are able to provide a statewide approach for a network of services, and we have accountability, which is to the local county elected officials as well as to the state, and it also allows us to tailor the programs and services to each community, and that's certainly something that's fairly unique in Minnesota, we believe. These services that we are going to talk about in public health include such things as controlling infectious diseases through immunizations, food safety through our licensing and inspection program in restaurants, and other environmental programs, And then looking at preventing and controlling chronic diseases such as asthma. And another area, counties are responsible for correctional health care. And in many of our counties, the public health departments provide that service. And that is certainly service delivery, acute and chronic health care service delivery that's a little unique and challenging on many days. We also have maternal child health programs that we can show effectiveness in assuring healthy babies through our family home visiting and WIC, and also health promotion efforts, as previously been mentioned, such as obesity. Our primary message is this. Health insurance and medical care services, while important or necessary, we believe are not sufficient. If we limit these investments only to these areas, we think we will fail in our attempts to improve the people's health and contain health care costs. And we believe that without a strong public health system to complement the medical care system, that Minnesota cannot succeed in controlling health care costs or improving health. The strategies that we think we should focus on include, first of all, looking at population health, prevention, early intervention, and the detection of disease. And we are not going to talk about treatment. I think somebody else might talk about the treatment mode. But we think those are the strategies that, in working in concert with a public health system and the clinical care, medical care systems, that we can really make a difference. All these strategies have implications not just for the community and government, but for business as part of that community structure. And one of the other things I just might add in this as was talked about electronic health systems and what has happened with that and cost savings, that is the Minnesota public health system does not have a connected information system to date. It's not automated. We have multiple standalone systems. So as we look at ways to measure outcomes, at ways to look at the interventions that do achieve those outcomes, we are a little hampered, if you will, at this time by how we can make those connections. And that's another example of how the public health community needs to connect with the medical care community on a number of our programs and services and have that ongoing. And I'll give some ongoing examples later on.
In order to contain health care costs, we really need to invest in community-wide population-based approaches. In doing this, we're not only focusing on treating disease, we're focusing really primarily on keeping people healthy. Keeping people healthy. When you think about the costs in the healthcare system, we can reduce usage of the healthcare system. Our approach to that should be to keep people healthy. This requires looking at the community's health status. In public health, we call that a community health needs assessment. And pulling together a look at not only the community's problems, but the community's resources, mobilizing each community's unique strengths. I'll give you an example of what's happening in my community right now. I see Dr. Herman is here. The Mayo Clinic, the Olmsted Medical Center, and others in Olmsted County have worked together on initiating an effort to improve the status of children who have asthma. And as we're looking at that issue, we're looking at it not just because we're looking at asthma as the disease of the month. We're looking at that because we think this is an example that crosses over systems, and we're looking at system coordination and system improvement. From the medical care provider's perspective, they've done an incredibly intense amount of work on getting children with asthma to be stabilized, to have an asthma action plan, to have the parents understand that plan. And the care provider is working with the parent for that child's best outcome. At the same time, the schools are looking at all children who have asthma in their school. They have an asthma action plan for each child, and they're trying to assure that a child who's not with their parent, that's under the protection of the school for the day, is able to participate in the classroom, in FIED, on field trips, in laboratories, wherever that might happen. And that child is on his or her own throughout the day at the time when they're not either in the school or with the family. So the thing that the health department is doing here is helping to pull together the stakeholders who are working with all of the children who have asthma in our community. We're looking at the medical care providers, the schools, the health department, the Asthma Action Coalition, So that sounds like something we've done in many of our communities, right? Well, we've often done it in relation to any given disease. What we're trying to do here is really look at how do we design a mechanism that we more naturally come together and put our system efforts together. Yesterday, I sat in on one of the first meetings of this group, and of course, they all brought the answer that they had created in their own system. And they were shocked. They were shocked to hear from each other how their piece of the system was not working in the next piece of the system. It's not rocket science. It's possible for us to find a way to link up all of these outstanding efforts, reduce duplication, and focus on the child, in this case, the child with asthma, and assuring that there is a consistent understanding throughout that child's set of caregivers about assuring that they are able to manage their asthma. But I think the piece of this that's really important is that, first of all, from the health department's perspective, we sat back and looked at what are the problems in our community. Asthma is a big problem in our community. How much of a problem is it? Who are the organizations and stakeholders that are involved with this? And how can we get more benefit out of the efforts that they're putting in? How do we coordinate those efforts? So community assessment is looking at who lives in the county or the community. Are they elderly? Are they low income? Are there new immigrants in this community? What health problems are associated with any of these groups? Are there gaps in terms of their risk for specific health problems and our ability to respond to them? What are the community assets that can be brought to bear on any of these particular issues? And how do we leverage those organizations that we don't always think of in terms of health care, such as the churches? Sometimes we aren't thinking of businesses as places that we can really get some assistance and support and who are very interested and invested in this. Who's looking at that overall in the community? That is your local health department. These are activities that it doesn't make sense to deal with one person at a time, which is how we have structured our health plan's approach to providing care. Their focus is to enroll individuals and assure that they get good care. We know that people move in and out of health systems and public and privately funded health insurance. We know that in order to look at population health, we have to be looking outside of that system at the population as a whole. Local governmental public health's approach to community assessment is based on looking at the scientific contributors to health and illness and the resources or the lack of those in the local community. Some of those are medical health-related resources. Some of them actually are completely different issues. If you look at the graph that was handed out that's entitled Health Status by the Centers for Disease Control, it's this one, you'll see that CDC reports that 88% of our national health expenditures are targeted at access to medical care, 88%. When in fact, studies have shown that the actual impact of this effort on health status is relatively small as compared to other factors such as health behavior, genetics, and environment. Half of the causes of death in the United States can be linked directly to negative health behaviors. However, less than 4% of the national health expenditures are directed at changing these negative behaviors. So when we're talking about obesity, for instance, think about whether we want to be expending most of our money on the medical side of the issue or if we want to be expending more money on the health behaviors side of the issue, or at least more money on the health behavior side of the issue. All segments of the healthcare system, whether they be health plans, clinics, hospitals, nonprofit organizations, provide services that are incredibly beneficial to persons with health problems. However, community efforts to address risky behaviors are frequently more effective and less costly when a community approach is taken. And as I said, when people move from one insurer to another, they lose access to services. Counties are looking at these individuals as a part of the entire community and working to maximize the value of various organizations' efforts. Probably the best way to look at the value of local public health is to look at it as the framework on which we can coordinate and hang some of these other community efforts. We certainly aren't the answer to all the problems, but the unique piece that we bring often is bringing others together to convene them to look at community-wide goals, coordination, local adaptations of best practices, and assurance. And assurance is an important piece of this, assurance that we're following through and achieving those goals. I've used the example of the asthma issue that we're starting to address. I could have used the example in my community of dental access, health care access in general, diabetes prevention, and obesity, all issues that my department is working on right now. As co-chair of Minnesota's eHealth Advisory Committee, I have to reiterate what Rena just talked about in terms of data. If we had a more comprehensive and coordinated interoperable public health information system that linked to information systems in the healthcare delivery system, we would be so much more effective in leveraging the things that are happening in the medical and healthcare system and in the public health system. And I think it's probably evident as you look at the kinds of issues I've just talked about.
I want to spend a little time on just highlighting several statewide programs that are delivered by our public health departments. And it just illustrates, again, the role that public health plays with clinical practice and blending when you look at what are the population public health goals and what can take place when the medical care intervention and also the clinical care practice. Those four programs are the WIC program, immunization program, family home visiting, and the waivered services that are delivered to disabled and elderly. And there is an immunization chart. Again, I hope you have picked this up. I'm not going to spend time on that. If you look at what we've done over a number of years where we sent excellent Representative Abler, if you look at what the goals we set for ourselves to improve immunization rates and protection of children's health, the strides we've made from setting those goals to the actual change and improving the immunization status of individual children and then an overall in population health is pretty outstanding. The other piece is the WIC program. This is a statewide program. This is delivered at the local level. We know that we can save anywhere from $1.92 to $4.21, and I want to use some hard stats, on medical assistance costs. And that is, again, working with, as we monitor health status, we monitor growth and development and prenatal care with pregnant women and children up to age 5. This is a key area where we can show health improvement with pregnancy outcomes and growth and development of children, and we monitor that very closely. And those numbers are increasing in our state in terms of the number of individuals that we're serving in that particular program. The other area is in what we call the waivered services, and we work with our social services partners on the local level. The costs that we have with elderly care and disabled care have been increasing. We know that. I understand the first baby boomer applied for Social Security, so we know what we're looking for, I guess, down the road. But there are ways that we have worked in cooperation with our social services departments to help look for alternative care in the home environment, in the most home-like setting in the community, and helping to look at there is prevention and intervention that can take place even if people have chronic diseases. What we look at are elderly as individuals that we do want to live stronger and longer in our communities at a better state of health and wellness. Social services departments, they help us in looking at housing, employment, and transportation, and that's all part of the healthy functioning. And there are cost savings that also are looked at. The last graph, thank you, Mary, is on medical assistance enrollment and spending by eligibility categories. And this is from 2005, and you can see where the costs are again, and this is looking at the medical assistance spending. And as we look there again in terms of what are our goals and what we can do, again, on looking at prevention activities, intervention activities, and working on that prevention of acute care and acute care hospitalizations and so forth. The last area that, and I'm quickly moving here to get into my 15 minutes of fame, I guess, but the last one is on family home visiting that I want to talk about a bit. We know that in there that there are programs that are tailored or customized according to the community needs and the services available in the community. The RAND Corporation concluded that for every dollar spent on this program, we do have $4 in future costs attributable to the problems that families encounter. And again, if we look back, all the WIC programs serve in many ways as a gateway to other services. As we look at individuals that have not received proper prenatal care, as we look at young children that aren't nutritionally healthy and how we can and look at that, we also look at that with home visiting from public health nurses and working with our ECFE partners in the community to help address growth and development issues and realize those cost savings. And we know what early prenatal care means, I think, for a healthy birth outcome. And Mary's going to talk again about one particular local program.
Just as an example of a local targeted home visiting program, Olmsted County, by virtue of the county investing local tax levy and connecting that with our state maternal and child health dollars, we've been able to deliver what's called the Baby Steps program, targeted toward women who are first-time parents, young adults, typically from homes where there has been a history of child abuse, limited social support, low income, and low education individuals. These are high risk women for child maltreatment. 5-year outcomes in this program indicate that 97% of the children were maltreatment free up to 24 months after graduation from the program. So that means that these children up to age 4 are maltreatment-free, high-risk families for maltreatment. 93% of the children demonstrated social, emotional, fine motor, and language development within normal limits. And 100% of the children in this program have up-to-date immunizations, well-child exams, and a medical home. That's because these are 3 of the 8 outcomes that we established for this program when we designed it, and we have worked continually to assure that we meet those goals. That's not unusual for local public health programs to work based on establishing outcomes, working and refining those programs to achieving them. But as I said, looking at a population-based approach, we can expand this in a much more significant way across the state if we want to use a population-based approach. We've given you some examples today. There are many more examples, and there's a lot of data. Unfortunately, we can't deliver the data to you as easily as we would like to, and that's part of what goes back to our information system piece. But we can tell you more about the kinds of public health interventions that are very effective across Minnesota. We'd like to share more of those with you. We'd be glad to do that or bring you that information upon your request. And we really appreciate your giving us a chance today to share some of this with you.
Thank you very much, Ms. Wellick and Ms. McManus. Questions, comments from the committee?
Madam Chair, one, I want to just commend you both for the work that you're doing. It's between the meeting today and Senator Sharon's meeting yesterday. It was sort of the first of all of these ones that I've said and where there's been much more of a focus on the overall sort of health promotion as opposed to just the medical stuff. So I want to compliment the chairs also for bringing that to the table today. But my only question is if you've given any thought to this may be a bad question, but how much more, I mean, if sort of thinking back to what Dr. Reed said about shifting what resources are available right now between the acute care to the public health, have you given any thought to how big a shift that would have to be or to, you know, really adequately fund the work that you're doing, particularly how it complements the private sector, particularly the primary care clinic work around the state? Do you have a thought on how much of a redistribution that would be to make that successful?
I can't say that we have a dollar figure attached to that. But I think that we could project what we could deliver for levels of investment and what kinds of outcomes you could expect for that. Part of that being our experience with what it has cost us to deliver some of the programs, such as the targeted home visiting one, which I just described. One of the issues with public health is that it's broad in scope. We deal, as Rena talked, we deal with elderly people. We deal with newborn people. We deal with people who we deal with disease surveillance in the community and, in fact, emergency preparedness. In terms of maintaining some of these programs, we're better able to predict what it would cost. In other areas, for instance, around the information system development, we have projections as to what it would cost to develop that program and then what we think it would cost to maintain it. So we could bring those things back to you.
Again, one of the, you know, not being able to put an exact dollar figure on, but if we look at the WIC program as an example of where we are an extension from that clinical practice again, and what we do in terms of monitoring growth and development and weight and prenatal, you know, care monitoring, I think we could put a cost figure on that too, if so asked to do.
Ms. Cadwell.
Madam Chair and presenters, and really we didn't set this up, honest. This is actually a question that I get asked sometimes. I think you've done a really nice job of talking about the importance of investing in prevention and promotion and a local emphasis. The question that I sometimes get asked that I'd like to hear your perspectives on is, why are counties best positioned to do this? Why not, you know, Mayo Clinic get a grant for Olmsted County to do the kinds of things you're talking about? Or why not, you know, XYZ nonprofit organization? You know, why local government?
Do you want to? I have a couple comments too.
Well, I think the motivation behind public health in local government is improving population health. That is our motivation. A lot of the nonprofit and public sector organizations and private sector organizations are motivated by competition, and there's a real benefit to putting together the focus on competition between businesses, between health systems. Putting that together with an organization like local government that's focused on population health outcomes, because you're going to get the best of innovation and creativity on both sides. And I think the focus on population means that every individual, whether they are disenfranchised, too problematic, too risky, or not exactly interesting for some reason at this point in time, those groups are never lost to public health, whereas they may be lost to other organizations that are looking for the best market share or the best way to use the systems that are available to them.
I think that another point is that we are located close to those we serve, and that we know the community resources. We have a history of working across different entities in the community and can help customize at the local level, you know, what might be the best framework for any kind of health system delivery that looks at public health and clinical practice and using nonprofits and other entities in the community to meet that need. So it's again, closest to those who deliver the service, and also the piece about working across so many different systems. So the school system and faith community and so forth. And so we can help leverage, if you will, that community investment.
And speaking of being close to the system, this interesting thing about the not electronic thing, not linked and all, relative to treatment coordination and home visits, does the average doctor who's got some asthma patient or some other person that you would be able to help out with know to call on you and coordinate his care with yours?
That really varies by individual situation, and often, even though the physicians know to call, there are such incredible system barriers. For instance, as we talked about asthma action plans, physicians and school nurses talked yesterday about the fact that they have protocols and mechanisms to use that in their systems, but they're cumbersome and at times prevent them from actually moving ahead. And probably the question that amazed most people was that each system had devised an asthma action plan based on what they thought was needed by others outside of their system, but they really hadn't connected with each other to ask if it worked or to ask what the others needed. So, for instance, one of the physicians said, does this plan that we're giving you, even if it gets to you, answer the things that you need? And doesn't it work in such and such a way? And the school nurse said, no, it doesn't. And here are the barriers: confidentiality, interest on the part of teachers. You just aren't addressing the things that happen in schools. And yet the physician could say the same thing in terms of the information coming back to them. So there's a lot to work out around those kinds of things.
Representative, if I might add on that, we're working out some of those in terms of some of the contracts that we have with the various health plans companies now in terms of the care management or case management, however you describe that. And I think it probably is uneven if there's, you know, high-risk issues going on and we're the case manager in elderly or other waiver populations. We might have that connection, but it's not very easy. We're in the world of faxing and telephone calling. And so it's just not as efficient as we think it could be, certainly.
We'll talk more about that. We're about out of time, but Senator Lynch
has a comment.
I'll make
just a quick comment. I really appreciate the information today. This is a very exciting time, I think, particularly for the Minnesota Department of Health. And so I encourage you to continue this conversation with Commissioner Magnin as she joins us. When you talk about establishing outcomes, I can think of no better time than the present to continue with those conversations. The other thing that you mentioned peripherally was that you briefly mentioned corrections. You mentioned education. I think in my own dealings in higher ed and even with the bonding committee, in all of those arenas, in one way or another, there have been discussions about healthcare access, healthcare cost, prevention, and I think as we continue the conversation going into the next legislative session, that we will see more so some of the inner workings between those, and we won't be maybe operating in so much of a silo as perhaps we heard you reiterate today. So thanks for helping to illustrate that more clearly for us.
Well, our time's up. Thanks for coming in. We weren't too rough on you, were we, today?
Thank you, Senator Lynch, Representative.
Who's next? We're going to go into the medical arms race. That's item number 2 on your agenda. And we'd like to welcome Dr. David Herman to the committee. Dr. Herman is medical director in employee and community health for the Mayo Clinic. And we are pleased to have you with us today, Dr. Herman.
There's a handout. Is this the handout?
This, before you begin, Dr. Herman, first of all, is there a handout?
No.
Okay.
Frank,
right, we'll
who's
follow.
Ill, was supposed to come up with me today.
Okay.
Has the handout somewhere, but
all right. We will follow along with your presentation. I will just note, and Dr. Reed mentioned in her earlier presentation to us today, she referenced a report from the Citizens League. And I don't mind telling you that it is that Citizens League report from April 2006 entitled Developing Informed Decisions, Seeking Market Reforms to Advise Medical Facility Expansion. And it was really based on review of that report that this topic comes before us today. So with that, Dr. Herman.
Thank you very much. My name is David Herman. I'm an ophthalmologist at the Mayo Clinic. But as my responsibilities as medical director is asset allocation. And we'll talk a little bit about asset allocation. It's probably the least interesting thing you'll talk about today. But we think it's important. And I'll go through some of the steps here. We do that. Mayo Clinic Rochester, we have almost 1,700 physicians, another almost 1,900 residents and fellows, and almost 25,000 allied health staff now. We have almost 2,000 licensed beds, 61,000 admissions per year, 103 operating rooms we open up every day. And last year we did a little over 50,000 surgical cases. So having the assets to be able to employ these people and to serve our patients is important. Our competition is global. We compete with other United States academic centers, but we also compete with other international destination centers. But within that, we have to have the capabilities to serve all of our patient needs. Our patient decisions are based upon their ability to come to see us, are based upon the availability of innovative and cutting-edge therapeutics. However, that doesn't mean that my role as medical director means everybody gets what they want. And I think if you wanted to make some phone calls, you'd find out that that's the case. Technology can drive patient care costs. I think it's important to recognize that it can drive patient care costs up, but it can also drive patient care costs down. The way we approach our assessment of technology, we feel it's best evaluated as a part of an overall resource utilization plan with articulated goals, and the patient care needs must be the driver. We have two aspects that we look at very, very closely when we talk about medical technology. I think one cannot be divorced from the other. The purchase of the medical technology through our capital allocation, and probably most importantly, then its employment within the practice to make sure that that technology is properly employed.
You can't separate these processes. In general, what we have found is utilization of medical technology drives the cost, not the capital expenditure. There are certain local market perturbations that can exist. For example, a single specialty group would not look at capital expenditures the same way a Mayo Clinic or a large multi-specialty group would look at a capital expenditure. A single specialty group would look at a capital expenditure within a very limited framework. If I'm a radiology group, does this purchase of the CT scanner, the MRI, or the PET scanner increase my bottom line? As a large integrated medical center, we have to say, from a patient service need, does the spending of this amount of dollars is best served here or here? What we find out when we look at local market perturbations, you'll find that the purchase is usually based upon reimbursement. Can a small, single specialty group be reimbursed for the capital expenditure for that piece of equipment? I think you'll find when you look at larger multi-specialty groups that that's not necessarily the driver. We control at Mayo Clinic the purchase of technology through the capital allocation process. Each expenditure that we look at has to compete with other projects and proponents. We also, on the other side of the coin, control the employment of that technology through a centrally governed clinical practice policies. And these policies serve to restrict the employment of technology to approved applications. Does it work? Is it cost effective? Does it serve the patient care needs? We do not try to bundle the research with the clinical practice. If a proponent comes forward with a particular piece of equipment that they want for a research purpose, we have them define what the research purpose is. We make sure they get IRB approval for the research purchase. If it can be used both in the clinical practice and for research purposes, we have that defined, and the level of its that technology's participation in each of those processes defined. We have found that it's not always, or maybe even perhaps often, that the expensive equipment drives the cost of care. Ironically, what we have found is the decreasing cost of technology increases its use in applications. Our threshold level at the Clinical Practice Committee for reviewing a piece of technology is $30,000. What we found in our practice is that when the price of an ultrasound machine dropped below $29,999, that we had to put brakes on the purchase of that equipment through the practice, because we could see a time when every patient got an ultrasound, no matter where they were getting their medical care within the clinic. And we did not feel that's appropriate. So the less expensive technology can slip beneath the capital review radar and drive up costs much more quickly than a single expenditure of a $3 million CT scanner or MRI. There are two broad categories we found of medical technology. There's the large capital revolutions. That would be the PET scanner, and one of them that we're looking at right now, a proton beam or heavily charged particle accelerators. Then there's the moderate and low capital evolutions, CT, MRIs, ultrasound, and what we're seeing as an increasing source of cost within our practice, laboratory testing equipment. As tests become available, as the tests reach a higher level, we have to spend a lot more money on the machinery and the technology to perform those tests. How do we allocate our capital? Well, we determine our capital availability through an adjusted depreciation of current equipment. We then put that into a pool, and then the functional units, which at Mayo Clinic Rochester are basically the departments, are solicited for capital requests. Those requests are then ranked by the proponents as being unlikely to need the expenditure within the next fiscal year, likely, or certain. What we find is that the expenditures that departments rank as certain rank above our capital expenditure ability by 150%. So we know at the beginning of the year that not everybody's going to get what they want, but we think we found a way for everyone to get what they need. The majority of our capital replacements are for, more majority of our capital expenditures are for replacement. So in 2006, we spent $23 million simply to replace the IV pumps in the Rochester hospitals. That's how expensive that technology is. Replacement almost always has an aspect of the new technology. So for example, although we're replacing this pump with this pump, the current pumps that we purchase are now interfaceable with the medical record. They can automatically chart the delivery of the medications in the medical record, and you don't have to have the nurse spending his or her time doing that. The number one big ticket items that we see are in radiology. That's because the machines are the most expensive. However, when we look at total capital expenditures, it's not necessarily in line with a single solitary department. We talk about the IV pumps that went to the Department of Nursing. They spent four times what radiology did, but radiology bought a lot fewer pieces of equipment. When we review, well, how do we review it? The first is medical need. Is this a piece of equipment? Is this technology needed to serve the patient? The next thing is a quality effect analysis. Will this make our practice better? There are a lot of things that we purchase for which there is no financial return. For example, a medication barcoding system where you spend millions of dollars does not increase your ability to charge the patient. It increases the ability to deliver your care more safely. There may be secondary gains from that because you're not giving the wrong medication or you're not missing a dose, but that's an incremental expenditure that makes things safer. We also look at a financial effect analysis. However, I would say that for much of the equipment that we buy, the financial effect analysis is negative. The cost that we spend on that piece of equipment is not recouped by our ability to charge the patient or the health plan for that. When we look at incremental activity, increased patient volumes is the primary driver. There are absolute increases in patient volumes, but also as we look across, there's expanding applications on existing patients. For example, 10 years ago, if you had trouble with your knee, the orthopedic surgeon would take the scope and go in and take a look. However, now the orthopedic surgeon can order an MRI, put a small coil on the knee, and get a much better resolution than they could ever get. And it keeps people out of the operating room, but increases the demands upon the technology. There is also some disruptive technology that can really change the paradigm of patient care. In general, that technology is very expensive. It sets a new direction for care, and it requires medical centers to look and say other capital needs must be deferred. For example, PET scanner, when we got into the PET scanner business, we're talking an investment of $10 to $20 million. When we're talking about a proton beam or heavily charged particle accelerator for the treatment of tumors, that's somewhere between $200 million and a $250 million investment before the first patient hits that machine. For those things, a special strategic review is needed. Because if you're going to make the decision to buy that piece of equipment, you have to understand that there's other things you're not going to be able to purchase. You're not going to be able to build a new building. You're not going to be able to replace some of the equipment that you have right now. You have to decide what's more important. When you're talking about a heavy charge particle accelerator, those are things that are high investment, but you'll also find that those are sectors of the what we would call the medical industrial complex, where you'll see that innovators, quote, entrepreneurs, want to get in there, provide those centers to get their return on investment for those centers. The first time we did a PET scanner review, we determined that it was not ready for prime time. And where other academic medical centers and other non-academic medical centers were making the investment, we decided it was not ready at that time and the purchase was deferred. However, we go back to the bucket and we take a look, and a second review several years later determined that it was a critical patient care tool. We have found that although it was expensive to purchase and operate, it dramatically decreased exploratory surgery for possible malignancy. So when I sit down with my thoracic surgeons and talk about their numbers at the end of the quarter, they complain about the PET scanner because they say, we used to do a lot of cases where we'd have to go take a look in the chest when a node was there or if there's a tumor in the lung. Now we can do a PET scan and see whether that's a hot node, meaning it's metabolically active, or it's a cold node, meaning that it's not metabolically active and most likely benign. So that's a case where a large capital expenditure made a big difference in both probably our bottom line and probably in a negative sense, but in a big advantage for the patient. Proton beam, heavily charged particle therapy, what we're looking at right now, is a type of radiation for cancer therapy. That has a significant potential for decreasing adjacent tissue damage, increasing function, and minimize complications. They are horrendously expensive. It's about $200 million to build. You have to hire another 100 staff to staff it. That becomes a strategic decision, but for us it also becomes a competitive decision. When we look at our economic impact of the Mayo Clinic for the state of Minnesota, it's about $3 billion per year. If we want to, as a national cancer center, continue to attract patients, one of the decisions we're trying to make right now is this piece of equipment necessary for us to remain a leading cancer care center in the United States and across the world? We haven't made that decision yet. We're looking at it very, very carefully. We're looking at partnerships across the state, looking at partnerships with private industry. How can we do this and do it well? Reimbursement can also affect decisions, but I want you to know that it's just not a physician wallet issue. The viability of all medical organizations depends upon their balance sheet. The question was asked earlier this afternoon. Do you use certain aspects of your practice to finance certain other aspects of your practice? And the answer to that is yes. Mental health services, we have a 100-bed mental health hospital, are never compensated to the point where it pays for the cost of care. Income generation varies greatly among service lines. Radiology wins, mental health services lose. Integrated medical centers can shift those revenues and cross-subsidize or cost-shift, and that's the second time you've heard that. How can single specialty groups reap windfalls? Well, how many standalone mental health centers profitable can you name in the state? You can probably name one. But then you have to ask your question, how does that center take medical assistance, Medicare, or no insurance patients? And the answer to that is no. So these asymmetries in reimbursement certainly drive investments, particularly when we talk about single specialty practice. Also, patient choice drives investments. If this was a rational marketplace, we would never have to talk about quality. If patients made their decisions on quality, each individual medical center, each individual system would be driving to get the highest quality possible. The fact that they're not means that that's not where patients are making their decision. Why would Hospital A buy an MRI when Hospital B has an MRI that's not being used 100%? Because they're afraid if the patients go over and see the MRI in the other building, the patients will make a decision regarding their care, and they will lose that patient from their practice. It's not a rational decision, but it's a decision that's made. What drives costs now? When we look at our balance sheet and we look at what's going up the fastest, these new biologic pharmaceuticals have great promise and application in cancer therapy, in the therapy of immunologic diseases such as rheumatoid arthritis, psoriasis, and Crohn's disease, but their cost is between $1,000 and $8,000 a dose. It's the single largest increase in expenditure across our practice, and the applications for those biologics are expanding. So when we're looking at how do we decrease the cost of care, how do we get a handle on it, we are still looking very, very carefully at our capital expenditures, but we're finding that these pharmaceuticals are far outpacing the capital expenditures in driving the cost of care. Laboratory testing. I just saw a draft of a paper the other day. Troponin is a test that's done in the ER to determine whether you're having a heart attack or not. A large group is determining right now that perhaps what we have determined as being a safe troponin level is not, which will increase the number of patients that could be possibly having heart attacks by a great number. That could dramatically change the cost of patients who present to the ER with chest pain. It could greatly increase the number of patients being readmitted for follow-up and retesting. And when we look at the number of patients we see in our emergency room who come in with chest pain, the cost of changing the levels on that test will far outweigh any technology expenditures we will make in 2008. Genetic and genomic tests are expensive. The utilization of those drives the cost. What we need to be careful of and what we need to assure when we're doing that is that those tests are providing the value to the patient and the value to society that justifies their cost. What would be a rational approach to decrease healthcare cost? I think the first thing we need to take a look at is minimize the reimbursement asymmetries, which would decrease finance-driven decisions and decrease the requirements for medical centers to invest in certain areas in their practice to pay for certain areas in their practice. This has come up. We need to reward evidence-based care decisions. We need to employ a long-range perspective on value-driven healthcare. When we look at the cost of our employee healthcare plan, which is about $300 million a year, we cover between about 70 and 80,000 covered lives in Mayo Clinic Rochester alone. Preventive care is the largest single health care cost for Mayo employees. The second largest is obstetrics. Those aren't costs that we can easily get rid of. We can do things better, I'm sure, but those aren't costs we can get rid of. We need to provide a framework that provides incentives for integrative care. Working with Mary Wellick has been a very exciting thing for us because if we're going to be doing something, we want to be able to do it right. To be able to leverage the resources of the Mayo Clinic and the leverages of Olmsted County Public Health is an important thing for our patients. Will it decrease the cost of care? Yes, it will. Will you see that decrease in the cost of care tomorrow? Likely not. It may increase our cost of care. When we talk about shifting money from acute care to preventive care, sometimes that's not the choice you can make because you have ill people right now, so you have to make the investment in that preventive care, but at the same time take care of the patients who are ill right now with acute episodes. The way we're trying to frame this at Mayo Clinic is we're trying to develop what we call a partnership for planned care. If we can plan your care, whether it's preventive care, chronic disease care, health and wellness, we can do it a lot more efficiently than we can when you show up for an acute care episode. We can engage you then, and we can do that. We'd be happy to come back and talk about more of that. There are also some patients who are asked to make a decision about how would you like your disease treated at this particular point in time. A good example is chest pain. If you have chest pain and you have normal left ventricular function, you can either treat them with medications or you can treat them with surgery. 10 years out, there is no difference in the outcomes of those patients. However, the expenditures over those 10 years is dramatically different. We need benefits incentives for informed self-care for those things that are preference sensitive, and we need public policy that encourages healthy lifestyles. The most important aspect that we can do right now to decrease the capital expenditures and the expenditures in the healthcare system in the future is to keep people healthy. With that, at the end of my formal comments, and I'd be happy to take questions. Thank you very much again for inviting me.
Thank you, Dr. Herman. Thanks. Committee, questions, comments?
All good right. Presentation. Thank you.
Thank you very much. at this sorry. Time, I'd
well,
like
Todd
to.
Had a question.
Oh, I'm sorry. Mr. Johnson.
Doctor, I wonder if you have a suggestion for the getting at the asymmetries of payment. I mean, do you have something in mind there? Or
I think you first have to look at what you're paying the least for. When we looked at chronic care, the decision that we made to the first disease we wanted to address is depression with our employees because we feel that that's where we can make the best headway. We feel it's been under-recognized. We don't feel we've looked at it hard enough, and we feel that's where the most benefits, the highest value for our expenditure for the dollar would come. I think it would be worthwhile to hear, if you haven't heard before, about some of the things that are underlying the Diamond Depression Project that's being sponsored by ICSI. Because when you look at what happens to members of our society who have untreated mental illness, the cost that it would take to treat that is minuscule compared to the cost to society for that. So mental health would be one of the first places I'd look, and we're backing that up by what we're doing right now. Preventive care in general is not reimbursed. I've gone to Washington, D.C., and we have a wonderful presentation that shows that if I ignore a hypothetical patient's care until they come to vascular surgery or cardiac surgery, I can make money on that. If I provide them preventive services so they never come to that and have a better life in general, I lose money on that. So depression, preventive services, and other things are places where you really have to look. In the short term, that will increase your healthcare costs. I think we have the tyranny of the urgent that presses us to make decisions that sometimes aren't very rational in the long term. If you decided to fund all preventive care, find ways or incentives to fund all preventive care across the state of Minnesota, your healthcare costs would go up tomorrow. But I will bet you and show you data that 5 years from now, Minnesota will be much more competitive as a state for industry and anything else you want to compete at because your healthcare costs will be lower.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much for the question, Mr. Johnson, and thank you, Dr. Herman. Ms. Cadwell.
Can I just ask one more question, Doctor? Just to follow up on that preventive cost being higher, is that because the N is bigger and spread across the whole population, or is it because the rate of reimbursement is lower, or is it both?
When we look at true preventive care costs, when you're talking about the wellness, the lifestyle coaching, working with people to lose weight, most of that's not reimbursed at all.
Okay.
When we look at our preventive
The
rate is zero. So the time that I spend in my office counseling you or talking to you about several different ways to lose weight.
There's no code for that.
There's no code for that. That's not compensated. that takes time from my visit that I can't provide.
Okay. Thank you. And is it also because you're delivering it to the entire population, whereas that comes into your office, whereas otherwise it would be a smaller proportion that you'd see for an acute
right.
or chronic disease?
When we
disease
talk about our
condition.
Employees, we talk about the 70,000 to 80,000 covered lives that we have, providing preventive care to them, which we actively encourage, because we have a very stable population of employees. Someone that comes to work for us at age 25 is still working for us at age 65 in general. We feel we can make that investment. We feel that long-term that will keep our healthcare costs lower and make us more competitive as a medical center when we compete with other national medical centers and international medical centers.
So from the perspective of the employer's self-interest, whether they think it's worthwhile to make an investment like that might depend on what their workforce is?
Very much so. It also depends as an insurer. If you are an insurer and you see high turnover within your portfolio of plans,
yeah.
why would I want to make an investment today for someone that's not going to be on my plan 2 years from now and someone else will recoup that cost? My shareholders will also ding me for that as well.
Thank you.
Well, that's very helpful. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Ms. Robineau?
Interesting.
Yeah. And there's you have the big handout, right?
Ms. Robineau is the co-founder of Patient Choice Healthcare. Welcome to the committee. We are happy to have you with us today.
It's this one.
Thank you, Vanna.
Thank you very much for inviting me to share some thoughts on the medical arms race. I'm Ann Robineau. I'm an independent consultant. I like to think that's a personality trait as well as a job. And, I gave this a version of this presentation at a National Institute of Health Policy meeting a few months ago, and I'm not sure who asked that I give it here again, but I think you'll hear a lot of familiar themes from the last speaker. So why is the medical arms race a problem? I don't know how much background this group has had in this discussion, so let me hit a couple of high points. One, if you're familiar at all with the research, and maybe this group has heard presentations on the Jack Wenberg and Elliot Fisher Dartmouth research, has that been something that's been discussed here at all? Okay. They've been doing research at Dartmouth for decades, actually several decades now, looking at variation in care delivery and quantities of care that are delivered in various pockets around the country. And that variation is enormous depending on the type of condition or procedure that is in question. And what has been learned through that research is that capacity of facilities, capacity of specialists in particular, are what drives demand. So we have supply-driven demand driving cost up. And what occurs with increased demand is that actually this same research has demonstrated that in parts of the country where there is excess capacity, outcomes are actually worse. So communities that have made the largest investments, for example, in cardiac care in the last 5 to 10 years are actually having higher mortality rates. And if you've ever seen some of the if you've ever seen the production curve where you look at investments in healthcare, you reach a point on the curve where you've optimized your investment, and then after that you start to spend more but get less. And we're kind of over the edge of that curve in many situations. So if I hadn't really come prepared to do an analysis of that research for you, but there's a book I would recommend that was just published a few weeks ago called Overtreated by Shannon Brownlee. Have you read it, Holly? It's pretty compelling, and it gets at this research and many other issues related to the medical arms race and others in a way that's very accessible for people who are not healthcare people and quite compelling. So I'd recommend as a homework assignment that everyone grab that book and read it. I think you'll be glad you did. Other issues, and the previous speaker mentioned some of these, when providers are making investments in capital expenditures or time, they are always making choices among scarce resources, and so to invest in excess capacity or redundant capacity is generally done at the expense of other things. So putting money into more and more PET scanners that may or may not be needed to assure appropriate access to the community are done at the expense of more mental health capacity, the ability to manage chronic illness, to do some of the preventive care kinds of things that the previous speaker was talking about, and for a long time at the expense of health IT, which would help inform decision-making and population health management but doesn't necessarily generate revenue. I would say another thing that we're seeing in our community today is the capacity of technology is driving consolidation. And there's an enormous amount of primary care acquisition that's occurring. We're kind of on wave two of that. We had the first wave about a decade ago. Those primary care independent clinics who weren't acquired in the first wave are either now been acquired or about to be or are looking for acquisition partners. And some of this, those who are doing the acquiring in some ways are looking to assure that there's primary care referrals into their system, and the primary folks need access to technology that they don't necessarily have. So there's serious problems. When I gave this talk at NIHP, I was asked to really think about, or what I wanted to project was, you know, why do providers invest in technology? And I tried to think about, well, what are the pros and cons for providers to do this? And again, the previous speaker talked about this in maybe a little more rational way from the perspective of Mayo. But here's how this really works in the minds of providers. And this doesn't mean they're bad people. I think our provider organizations are full of very professional, well-intentioned people responding to perverse incentives in the marketplace. So today, if you're a hospital or if you're a multi-specialty clinic group, why would you buy technology capacity that already exists in this market? Well, for one thing, that's where the money is. So profits or reimbursement margins occur in procedures and technology. Imaging is profitable. Procedures are profitable. Office visits are not. Education is not. So if you're a provider, you need to make a margin so you can cover some of the cost of other things and continue to grow. It's prestigious. I mean, you don't ever see people on the front page of the paper with a new counseling for their patients with obesity. You see the new neurosurgical center with the MRI that rolls in and out that turns out we have now in multiple places in the state of Minnesota. That's very prestigious and impressive. And something that would be desirable from a provider to invest in. Providers or facilities in particular who don't make investments in technology risk losing their physician capacity because they'll go where the technology is. And I think physicians are very interested in being able to use the most current, highest tech capacity. And if that isn't available at the hospital where they are now, they may want to look for other partners where it is available. I already mentioned covering unprofitable services. The physician from Mayo mentioned that in their cancer care, they're looking at making an investment, and I can't remember, did he leave, the name of the $250 million investment they're considering making, but he specifically said if they're going to attract cancer care from across the country, it's important to them to be able to retain that market share. And in order to do that, they have to make these technical investments. It's very important if you're a hospital and you're getting capital through bonding, you have to maintain or grow your market share or your bond ratings drop. And so if you are not investing in technology and you're losing market share as a result, or you're reducing admissions as a result, or if you're investing in things that are not necessarily resulting in admissions but instead are avoiding costs, by keeping patients healthier, you actually shoot yourself in the foot because that reduction in market share will actually hurt your ability to raise money in the future. Mm-hmm. I would also say that there are a number of different initiatives, both public and private, where there are attempts to drive volume to providers who are performing higher volumes of certain services. Bariatric surgery might be one example. Cardiac surgery is another for different entities. And Medicare has some of these as well, where there are volume thresholds to stay in, to continue the ability to perform certain functions. And if you're going to do that, you have to be investing in technology or you lose the ability to provide that service at all. I think Abbott, Todd, what was the service Abbott lost the or is in negotiations with Medicare on that they weren't doing enough of? It was the summer.
Just a question on some cardiac stuff.
It was some kind of cardiac service, yeah. So whether it's appropriate or not, it's incumbent upon providers to do that. And last but I don't think least, high tech is sexy. I mean, if you're a hospital trustee, it's a lot of fun to go to a cocktail party and talk about this very cool new 64-slice CT scanner, which, if any of you haven't seen it, is so impressive. You know, I think it's unavoidable that these kinds of things are attractive and fun to invest in, much more fun than opening up a few new mental health beds. And why wouldn't you, if you're a provider, invest in this kind of technology? And honestly, the only thing I could come up with when I gave this presentation was it's upsetting to managed care executives who are trying to manage the total cost of care, and in some cases that's not perceived as a con. So I think that we have a distorted market that is driving providers in this direction, and absent changes in the underlying incentives, we're going to just keep getting more of what we have. So what might you want to think about as a committee as you think about these kinds of things? How is this environment different today than it was a few years ago? This has been going on for a long time, and I would say that it's much worse. You know, the longer we wait to align incentives around things that we really want to get for value from healthcare, the more capacity gets developed and the more there's a need to create a use for that capacity in order to amortize the investment. It would have been easier to have this conversation 10 years ago. It would have been easier to have it 20 years ago. Doing nothing just makes this problem worse and worse. I had this conversation with a hospital CEO or a health system CEO just on Monday, where he was asserting that he knows that in the future it's going to become necessary for them to deliver value on a population health basis. I mean, he sees kind of where the world is going to have to head as more accountability for providers in the area of managing total cost of care for populations. But in the meantime, they're building more capacity. So hopefully this shift will come soon before there's more and more of this capacity that still will have to be fed. And why do we think we can change this now? I've been in this industry for over 30 years, and I'm not sure we can change this now. I think we have a lot more interest, and there's committees who are talking about these kinds of things, but I'm not yet sure that there's a political will to change this. And make no mistake, this will require a lot of political will to reverse. So what are some things, this is not in any way, by the way, intended to be exhaustive, but just highlighting a couple thoughts about what could we change that might reverse this situation. We can change how we pay. We can change how providers look in terms of their reputation, in terms of where they make their investments. We can shift market share. We could change how bonds are rated, and we could look at not-for-profit status. First, let's talk about holding providers accountable. Today, as I mentioned, there are all kinds of incentives for providers to invest in this kind of technology, whether it's really necessary in the community or not. And I think what we need to do is change the rules of the road so that providers who are in making investments in redundant technology maybe aren't getting the gains that they hoped. One is more transparency on cost and quality. And I'm sure you've talked a bit about transparency in this group, and if you haven't had a lot of discussion on that, that would be a topic worth pursuing. Consumers need to be educated on the incremental value of some of the care that they get, that more is not better. And I think consumers need to get a better grasp of provider economic incentives. You know, if I could make every consumer in Minnesota read the book I just mentioned, I think we'd get a long way down that path. More health care is dangerous to your health, and consumers don't understand that today, but if they did, would ask different questions and request different things from their providers. And then I think we need to realign the incentives to reduce income for providers who are not efficient or who produce poor quality, and you've heard some of that already today. I think Maureen Reed talked about some of that and probably others. What are some ways to think about redesigning reimbursement that are things that perhaps could come out of recommendations in this committee? You'd want to go into more depth on these, but essentially we should be paying providers based on their value, which is the total cost of care and the quality of managing populations or conditions. And there are lots of different ways to do this, and I'm not here to recommend any particular one. Probably a combination will be the best thing that we can come up with. But until we realign the reimbursement so that we get accountability for quality and cost for the management of populations, we're going to continue to see investments that have to be fed and cost-driving behavior. So some of the things you can do in this arena, tiered networks where you differentiate providers to consumers based on their performance on cost and quality metrics, payment for service packages such as a total payment for the management of cardiac care for risk-adjusted populations, which may or may not then lead to surgery that's necessary or unnecessary, payment for low back pain, for example. A lot of surgery done on low back pain without a lot of evidence that it's going to work. Today, if you do the surgery, you make money. If you don't do the surgery, you lose money. If we compensated based on the overall management of that population, we'd see a more aligned way of dealing with the economic incentives. We can work with reference price plans where purchasers create an allowance towards a purchase of certain types of care. And if there's a cost in excess of that because of inefficiency or excess capacity, then that's passed on to the consumer, who then starts asking value questions about that. And we can also be requiring warranties. There's some work being done about this actually at Geisinger in Pennsylvania, where they're currently warrantying the cardiac surgery results that they perform. So if there's a readmission or a complication, that's not done at additional cost. Today, again, our provider incentives, the worse you do, the more you get. You know, if you get a patient and you send them home and then they come back to the hospital, you get paid again. I think there are perversities in that that need to be corrected. Underlying payment structures, I think a question was raised before about one area to start with in rationalizing some of this. Today, there's a lot of profit in cardiac care. There's no profit in mental health care. You could look at revising underlying reimbursement structures to tilt away from where there's excess capacity and towards where we need more capacity. So moving money away from cardiac care, from orthopedic care to mental health care would go a long way to rationalizing where investments are being made. Similarly, the way physicians are paid today, there's a lot more money in procedures than there is in cognitive services, and we could reweight how we reimburse even under our existing fee-for-service environment to pay more for cognitive services and less for procedures, and you would see more cognitive services and fewer procedures if we did that. Lots of other tools, some of which this committee may have some influence on, creating some pressure on bonding where if we changed some of these capital investments so they weren't driving margins in a positive way, we could stop having capital investments that way because no margins would hurt the ability of hospitals and others to raise money through bonds. And then public entities who purchase bonds, I'm sure the state of Minnesota, for example, is a big bond purchaser for its pension funds, et cetera, could look at driving volume to providers who are delivering higher value. I think there's a big opportunity to set the bar higher on not-for-profit status and to use that as a weapon. And I'm not an attorney, and I don't know all the laws about not-for-profit status, but certainly moving more towards expectations about improving community health standards, providing value, using resources appropriately, participating in transparency initiatives, and participation in new reimbursement methodologies that realign incentives could in some ways be linked to not-for-profit status, which would be a very powerful lever in this state. Changing value thresholds, and at the bottom I said put women in charge, and that was back to my high tech is sexy comment. I'm sorry if I'm offending people, half of you, but I do think that there is more of a nurture versus technology bias, or a caring versus curing bias that we need to tilt more towards caring and away from some of the curing that isn't really curing but is using a lot of high tech. And this applies to everyone. So consumers need to understand more isn't better. A lot of education needs to occur. Perhaps we can use our Department of Health and public health initiatives to help get this message across. I see this as a long-term investment, sort of like the environment. You know, when we had the first Earth Day 26 years ago, you know, it's taken that long to filter some of those messages into society. We need to start consumers understanding that more isn't better, and that when they do have more, it's costing them money, whether it's directly or indirectly. I think there are a lot of things for policymakers to do, a lot of response to regulation, chewing up resources. Where we need to make investments is in more transparency and consumer education. I think policymakers can help pave the way for reimbursement changes, and as I mentioned, using not-for-profit status as a lever for change. Purchasers and public and private purchasers are a huge part of the problem, where today most purchasing decisions around health plans are looking at health plan products that have the broadest network with the deepest discount and don't really look at the value that's underneath that. And as long as purchasers are driving in that direction, you're going to see more and more volume as an attempt to make up for deeper and deeper discounts, which isn't really getting us what we want. Plans need to step up, and so far there isn't really a strong incentive for this to happen, but purchasers need to push plans to develop more sophisticated contracting models that create products and provider contracts so that there's competition on value. And then providers, in response to these changes, would then have the opportunity to re-engineer in response to those changed incentives. So just ending on one note, we can't do everything, and I don't think we've recognized this. We are going to have to at some point start saying no to some kinds of care that is not adding incremental value. And I think we need to start discussing where that is. And I guess that sort of gets you more towards the R word of rationing. But we do need to think about more rational ways of using our healthcare dollars and having every facility with every kind of technological capacity used on every patient, whether there's an incremental addition to outcome or not, is insane and will only drive us further down this road. So that's the end of my comments, and if you have any questions, I'd be happy to take them.
Ms. Romano, thank you very much for the information. Committee members, we'll start with Ms. Roden first.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair. Hi.
Hi.
I just had a question on the cost and value, the cost and quality piece, just because do you have any thoughts on how, I mean, the value piece is a little, the quality piece is a little easier to get to, in that there's, there are measurements out there on that. But on the cost piece, do you have any thoughts on how we really get down to what it actually costs anybody to do anything in this medical system?
Well, there's cost and there's price, and I think we need to understand both of those things. Cost really is a function of the resource inputs that go into achieving a certain outcome for either populations or defined conditions underneath that. And there are initiatives that are starting to look at some of that. The organization I used to run did a lot of analysis around cost variation among provider entities to manage like populations. And what we learned is there's huge variation in what it costs to manage a population with similar outcomes. And we didn't just find that here in Minnesota. We did work on this area all over the country. And there's an enormous gap in how effectively provider organizations use resources to manage patient populations. And then there's price, which is what actually is paid to for those resources. And that's quite invisible as well. So there, I think, is a lot of interest currently, particularly among purchasers, in getting more transparency on both those dimensions out. I think Minnesota Community Measurement is looking at starting an initiative to measure some of those things, which would be a good place to do some of that.
Ms. Stein, did you have a question?
Given that the discussion we're having here affects primarily directly public programs, and public programs are notoriously known to have poor reimbursement, are there opportunities to use reimbursement incentives in the community?
Well, I think in particular, if public programs were to start to reimburse for population outcomes and outcomes protect around specific conditions of interest in public programs rather than procedure by procedure, and if public programs were to start to tilt more towards cognitive and management services, I think you'd have a you'd be able to pay a more reasonable amount for those kinds of services that aren't getting adequately compensated today, and you would have savings on things that are being done that could be avoided if you were managing the care of these of this patient population more effectively from the get-go. So I think in particular public programs, because they don't pay providers as well, providers are really open to working with those in ways that, that might make better economic sense for both parties.
Thanks. Sorry we're out of time, but it was very interesting. So.
Thank you.
Sonia, you've been very patient. You want to come up and give us your thoughts?
Just asking if the presentation is loaded.
Yeah, it's on F.
It's on F.
Is there a handout too? This is your handout?
Yes, it is.
Okay, there's a handout, class.
Got it. Yep.
It will be a test, Dan. Just pay attention.
Thank you. My name is Julie Sonier. I'm director of the Health Economics Program at the Minnesota Department of Health, and I was asked to speak to the work group today about Minnesota's capital expenditure reporting law, which is a mechanism for tracking and reviewing major capital expenditures made by healthcare providers in the state. Just as a quick overview of this presentation, I'll talk briefly about the history of the capital expenditure law and then talk about how the process works and then finish up by describing some major changes that were made to this law during the 2007 legislative session. Senator Lynch was the author of this bill, so she's probably very familiar with them, but I will talk about them briefly for others who may not be aware of them. So just as history, the capital expenditure reporting law was enacted as part of the 1992 Minnesota CARE Act, which, as you know, was a very broad reform bill with some very far-reaching measures that were intended to improve access, cost, and quality of health care in Minnesota. It was actually intended to be an interim measure that was to be in place until other methods for containing costs were developed and implemented. Later on, many of these other cost containment measures were repealed or allowed to expire, but the capital expenditure law remains in effect. The information that providers have to report to the department when they make a major capital expenditure is they have to provide us with a description of the project, its purpose, and the amount of money that was spent, the date of the major spending commitment, its expected impact on patient charges, its impact on clinical effectiveness and quality of care. They have to provide information on the extent to which equivalent technology or services are already available or the distance to those services. They have to provide a statement describing whether they pursued any collaborative arrangements with other providers, and they also have to provide a statement of assurance that they will not use procedures or technologies that are not clinically effective and cost-effective except for experimental and research purposes. The threshold for reporting these projects is any capital expenditure project that exceeds $1 million. Initially, this was a $500,000 threshold, but it was raised about 4 years ago to $1 million. The reports historically have been due within 60 days of a provider making a spending commitment, but as I'll describe in a minute, this has been we're transitioning to a new system, which will be an annual reporting system. When MDH receives a report, we conduct the retrospective review of the appropriateness of the expenditure in terms of its impact on healthcare cost, quality, and access, and that is as specific as the criteria in the law get. If a provider is found to have failed this retrospective review, what happens is that they can be placed on prospective review, which means that their future capital expenditures have to be approved in advance for a period of 5 years. In practice, prospective review orders under this law have been rare. Just as a summary of the capital expenditure trends in Minnesota since this law has been in effect, over $5 billion in total spending has been reported, and over 1,000 reviews have been completed. About two-thirds of the spending has been by hospitals, and about three-quarters of it has taken place in urban areas. This chart just shows the capital expenditures for each year of reporting. And as you can see, there is some significant variation from year to year. So in some years, a small number of very large projects have bumped up the totals substantially. The average per year since the year 2000, is about $400 million a year. Finally, I wanted to just talk about the legislative changes that were made this past year and what led to those changes. In February 2007, the department submitted a report to the legislature on medical facilities investment, and one of the findings in that report was that the capital expenditure reporting law has not likely had a lot of impact on medical facility investment decisions in Minnesota, but that the data that's been reported under the law over this time period has provided important insights into overall market trends. One of the other major findings was something that is echoed in a lot of the presentations that you heard today, which is that the payment incentives in the system really are a driver of much medical facilities investment. So the fact that we overpay for some services and underpay for others is really an important factor that drives facility investment. So the 2007 legislative changes that were made was the reporting was transitioned into an annual reporting system, and one of the things that that does is it allows for collecting the data in a more comparable way so that we can analyze the market trends and have a more systematic way of looking at what's going on with capital investment in the state. And it also streamlines some of the reporting requirements from providers. So this new annual reporting will be combined with other existing data reports from hospitals, surgery centers, imaging centers, and physician clinics. The requirement for retrospective review of major spending commitments was retained in the law. So in addition to this annual report, providers still need to provide the department with sufficient information on the project so that we can conduct this review. Madam Chair and members of the work group, thank you for your time. I'll be happy to answer any questions that you have.
Sounds like a great law change last time, huh? How much time do you spend reviewing this stuff? Is there much money allocated in your budget?
Representative Abler,
these retrospective reviews.
You know, it varies kind of a lot, but on average, I would say it's about a half an FTE.
That's not a big part. So this become more just a reporting thing. You kind of got moved to where you'd the law moved to where you really become just as a data collection thing more than a there's no breaks involved in this anymore, really, right?
We still do need to do the retrospective review, and I would say that it is true that many of the reports that come in are fairly easy. They're, you know, it's something like replacing some old equipment that's worn out and dangerous, and you don't have to spend much time on that review. But there are others which are either very large projects or, you know, projects where there's been a lot of investment made in the community, such as imaging, that do require substantially more time on our part to do those reviews.
But you said you really don't go back and do anything about it. So it's, I mean, there's no slowing. This hasn't proved to be any kind of a slowing the process procedure, right? More of just a keeping track of it.
Representative Abler, one of the reasons we think that it did not really slow capital expenditures is that the law is a relatively weak law. It is reviewing expenditures after the fact, so the project can't be, we don't have authority to require the project to be undone. And the criteria are rather vague, perhaps because it was intended to be a temporary measure. So there's almost always an argument that can be made that the project improves access, cost, or quality in some way. Even states that have a very strong prior approval, so certificate of need states, much of the research evidence indicates that that really doesn't have much of an impact on the overall level of medical facilities investment, even with some of those stronger provisions in place.
Thank you. Sue.
Ms. Stout.
If certificate of need programs don't seem to work in other states, are we left with changing the incentives as the only thing that you think is going to impact this decision?
Madam Chair and Ms. Stout, that was probably the primary conclusion of the report, which was that payment systems really need to be made more accurate so that incentives are aligned in ways that the previous speakers today have have described, so that it doesn't pay to make excessive investments in medical technology.
Thank you.
Other questions or comments? All right. Thank you very much. I thought in light of the discussion today that it would be good for everyone to have kind of a baseline of sort of where we really are in Minnesota. So thank you very much. And
the best for last.
Lastly.
Don't feel any pressure or anything.
Mr. Godfrey is going to talk with us a little bit about what they are doing in the state of Washington. Mr. Godfrey.
Madam Chair, work group members, I've been asked to present some information prepared by Katie Kavanaugh from Senate Counsel on the Washington Health Technology Assessment Program, or also known as HTAP. And in your packet should be a memo like this and several other handouts. The HTAP program was created in 2006. The purpose of the program is to ensure that the health technologies purchased by the state of Washington are safe and effective, and that coverage decisions made by different state agencies are consistent and transparent and based on evidence-based information. The program involves the collaboration of five state agencies and their purchases of health care. The lead agency is the Health Care Authority, which is the state of Washington's equivalent to DOER, purchases health care for the public employee groups, the Department of Social and Health Services, which is their Medicaid agency, the Department of Labor and Industry, Workers' Comp, and Department of Corrections and Department of Veterans Affairs. There are three primary groups that are responsible for the administration of the HTAP program. The first is a HTAP work group with interagency representatives that meet biweekly to discuss the program development and issues and technologies that might want to be considered for review. Also, each of those agencies must designate an agency medical director, and those medical directors are the second actors really in this whole process, and they meet as a consulting body to the program and prioritize and recommend the technologies to be reviewed. And the final group is a Health Technology Clinical Committee made up of 11 members who are appointed by the State Healthcare Authority. Six of those members on this group must be practicing physicians, and the other five are other practicing professionals who use health technology in their practice. Two of those members must have professional experience treating women, children, elderly, and individuals with disabilities, and individuals with diverse ethnic and racial backgrounds. The members of that group cannot work for a health technology manufacturer or for any of the participating state agencies. And during the time on the work group, they may not have a substantial financial conflict of interest. According to the legislation, the state must, or the HTAP program must review up to six technologies the first year and up to eight technologies in the second year. The legislation required that the HTAP work group create a tool to assist in assessing and prioritizing the technologies based on the criteria set forth in the legislation. There are four steps in the review process. The first is the administrator of the healthcare authority, in consultation with the other agencies, selects the health technologies to be assessed. And in making that selection, the priority is given to any technology for the following three reasons. There's concern about the safety and efficacy of the cost effectiveness of the technology. The actual or expected state expenditures are high due to demand for the technology, its cost, or both of those reasons. And finally, there is adequate evidence to conduct a complete review. Once the technologies have been selected, the next step is for the administrator to contract with a technology assessment center that's been designated by the federal government to do healthcare research to conduct an evidence-based assessment of the technology's safety, efficacy, and cost effectiveness. The assessment center then, after they've done that, or they conduct the review and writes a report, summarizes the evidence, and then sends that back to the state. The report then is given to a clinical committee, the clinical committee made up of the practitioners, who will use the report to decide whether the technology is shown to be safe and effective and whether the state agencies will pay for the technology and under what circumstances. And that review and decision process typically takes between 6 and 12 months. The committee coverage decision process is basically as follows. The committee determines whether the health technology will be included as a covered benefit in the health care program of the participating agencies, and if it is covered, the criteria under which the participating agencies they will use to decide whether that technology is medically necessary or not. The committee provides an opportunity for the public to comment, may also establish a temporary advisory committee to do further review of the particular issue and get more public input. The determinations must be consistent with decisions made under Medicare and also consistent with expert treatment guidelines, unless the committee concludes that this substantial evidence regarding the safety and efficacy and cost-effectiveness of the technology supports a contrary determination. And then also here, after a particular determination has been made, the group may reconsider or re-review that decision once every 18 months if the administrator decides there's evidence that it needs to be redetermined. And then in terms of the agency compliance, once the decision's been made, the technology, the HTAP group puts out basically its decision to different agencies, and in your packet you'll see you have two summaries of two reviews that's already been done. One is on pediatric bariatric surgery, and the other is upright positional MRI. And once those are sent to the agencies, then they basically must adhere to whatever those guidelines are. And in the case, for instance, of pediatric bariatric surgery, the decision was made not to cover any bariatric surgery for patients under the age of 18, and that for those patients between 18 and 20, it's a covered benefit only if the criteria identified in the document is met. And individuals have a right to appeal the decision not to cover their services based on the guidelines produced by the HTAP committee, and those appeals are handled under an ALG process at the agency level. And then finally, the HTAP committee must give public notice through an internet-based communication or through an internet-based site. And then finally here, we also summarize the technologies that have been selected thus far by the group to review. The first two we've already mentioned, which have been completed, bariatric surgery for pediatrics and upright positional MRIs. Lumbar fusion and discography is in process of being done. The next round will look at cardiac stents, artificial discs, arthroscopic surgery of the knee, CTA for cardiac care, virtual colonoscopy, and intrathecal pumps. And then finally, I'd just like to note that Washington has joined a consortium of state programs. Minnesota is a member of that program of that consortium as well. It's being led out of the Oregon Health Science University Center. And also, just to make some other notes here about the difference between what Minnesota is currently doing under kind of our evidence-based effort through the Minnesota healthcare programs or our public programs. The difference between this approach and Minnesota's current approach is that Washington applies this to all of their state-funded healthcare programs, not just the public programs for low-income people. And also, Minnesota uses prior authorization, whereas Washington actually makes coverage decisions about what to pay for and what not to pay for. And there's also more community input in the Washington process. And one final note on the fiscal aspect of this. Apparently, the state appropriated $500,000 to get this thing going. They didn't book any savings as a result to what the committee would do in its work in terms of limiting coverage of certain services. And I find that kind of surprising, given that we've taken savings in the past for our prior authorization efforts. And with that, I'll take any questions.
Ms. Cadwell.
Mr. Godfrey, just a quick question. You said it's beyond public programs to state programs. Does that mean state employees? Or?
Yes, okay. Yes. And, in fact, as I mentioned earlier, it's the Health Care Authority, which is the Washington agency responsible for public employee insurance, is their lead agency.
Do you know what proportion that is of enrollees?
I don't.
Okay.
Is there a list of stuff that other states, that Washington other states have declined to pay for? Is this little list here, do you know?
Madam Chair, Representative Abler, my understanding is that Washington right now is one of the only states that have actually gone among those states in the consortium who are this far along. Oregon being the other one, and we've heard about that approach already. But this is really, I think the difference here between Washington and Oregon is Washington's focus is really on newer technologies that are coming online.
Oh, yeah. Thanks a lot. We're out of time. Time to go.
Okay. Thank you very much. Good information.
Next time we have a few presenters, but mostly we're going to talk, right?
Mostly next time we must have a few presenters. I think you're going to have your homework between then and now is you will be receiving via email a list just by topic of just to refresh our memories of what we've heard from or what different topics we have touched upon. And I think that it's our hope that next time we come prepared with I think as you look at that list, it would be helpful before you come next time if either mentally in your mind you had some sense of, in your view, if you had to prioritize that list, what that might look like. I will caution you in conversations that I've had with Senator Berglund and Representative Huntley, it is possible, and I would say that the expectation is that every single topic that we've discussed won't necessarily go forward to the full commission. In fact, there will be a few things that do go forward, and there may even be, as Representative Abler and I have discussed, there may be a couple of things where we might choose to continue to pursue, but we maybe feel that they're just not quite ready to go to the full commission at this point in time. And
part of our goal is to get some stuff that we can at least put together to send to the department for just some cost analysis to see if there's any savings or not. And I think the more ideas, the better, and hopefully the best ones will dribble to the top. But I think all the ideas are open. And if there's something we haven't heard about that you just want to throw out there, I think that's perfectly fine, too, right?
Send a note.
Sort of fine.
I guess in summary what I would say is I really think I think all of these meetings have been important and time well spent, but I think that the next meeting in particular, that it is important for the members of the committee to be here.
Madam Chair, will the committee be expected to provide fiscal notes of savings related to this?
Yes, and so...
the department.
Right. Will be our assignment to Mr. Godfrey and the team.
And will that be for everything that's been put forward, or will that be for only the ones that you've identified promising?
We'll decide that next time, but my sense is that it won't be for everything, just in fairness of time and
he doesn't like to sleep, does he?
So I would suggest that we choose a number, 1, 2, 3, 4, of items to ask staff to put together for us. All right, Ms. Stein.
Are you going to give us the criteria we should use? I mean, one of the questions is, are we looking at short-term?
We will send out some. We'll remind you of our charge and the guidelines that we kind of started with as we do that. Good suggestion.
Yeah, but I think you want to think broadly. I think long-range and short-term, it's a fool's game to only think short-term. In my mind. So see if that catches on anywhere else. But.
Thank you, everyone, for your time.
Yeah.
We need to get some.
get out of here.
See you later. It's the next meeting.
Oh, no problem. You know, I will, and I'll talk to Representative Abler about this, but in the next few days, I'm going to send out an email to all the chairs of working groups just saying, here's kind of what the fiscal process looks like. Now, the problem is right now, they told us originally that they were going to be able to get start working on our stuff in the middle of October. Now it's been put out to end of November.
Of course.
So we're probably not going to get anything back until Thanksgiving.
Oh, it doesn't synchronize.
So
that'd be a bummer.
And I think the process would be good.
And I think prioritizing is important. And so, I mean, what you said, I thought was good.
Good. All right. Yeah. I'll be